You are listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I am your host, Celine Yeager. Each week, I bring you advice from athletes, scientists, researchers, and other experts to help you feel and perform your best, no matter what your hormones are doing. This show is a production of Live Feisty Media. Hello, strong, feisty women. I hope you all are well. So, hang with me here during the intro this week, because it's going to be more detailed than usual, because we're talking brain health, and it's a big, important topic that just really deserves more space, context, and nuance. This week's guest is neuroscientist Dr. Sarah Mackay, the author of the Women's Brain Book. I wanted to have Sarah on for this conversation because she devotes her professional life to studying women's brain health along with the related research, and she always does bring a lot of nuance to the conversation that I really appreciate. Sarah explains all of the factors that influence midlife and menopausal cognitive health, and we talk a whole lot about Dr. Lisa Moscone's work, because Dr. Moscone is the seminal researcher in this space, and as many of you I'm sure know, has a new book, instant bestseller out, called The Menopause Brain. I have it. I've read it. I highly recommend it. Since we reference her work a lot here, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to provide clarity and context on her work to set the groundwork. In 2021, Dr. Moscone, dropped a groundbreaking brain scan study in Scientific Reports that shows that our brains physically change during perimenopause. Physically change. And I'll just read Dr. Moscone's own summary of her work that she put in Instagram here, because she explains it really beautifully. And it's something that I think a lot of people have never really thought about. So she says, we associate menopause with the ovaries, but in reality, our brain is as impacted as our ovaries are. In fact, 80% of women experience brain symptoms during menopause, including hot flashes, insomnia, depression, brain fog, and forgetfulness. Those symptoms start not in the ovaries, but in the brain. Our new study is the first to fully map out the brain effects of menopause. We did a ton of brain scans showing that the transition to menopause involves myriad changes to brain structure, brain region connectivity, and brain energy consumption. When we started looking into this, we anticipated negative changes. But what we discovered is a much bigger and more encouraging story. For example, during menopause, women's brains undergo declines in glucose metabolism, a source of energy. However, the brain seems to compensate for these declines by increasing blood flow and ATP production, which is the currency of all cells. Also, while gray matter is reduced during menopause, in many brain regions, these declines are transient, even reversing by the time menopause is complete or in the years afterward. Importantly, women exhibiting this brain recovery also show preservation of memory and cognitive performance. It's important to note, on a less rosy note, that not all women do experience the same recovery, and women in the study who had a genetic variant associated with a higher risk of developing Alzheimer's disease accumulated more amyloid beta plaques, which are associated with Alzheimer's, during perimenopause than women and men without that genetic variant. So that's all super important, groundbreaking study. Lisa Moscone followed that research up with another study that we talk about too in this episode, which is a systematic review and meta-analysis on the effects of menopause hormone therapy on the risk of Alzheimer's disease and dementia, which she published in Frontiers in Aging Neuroscience in October of last year. That's obviously important because if we're talking about these brain changes associated with the hormone shifts and decline, the next logical step, which research has been looking at for quite a long time, is where does hormone therapy fit into that picture? So I'll just read the study's conclusion and Dr. Moscone's takeaway here. It says, the meta-analysis found that in midlife, estrogen-only therapy was associated with a moderate 32% reduction in Alzheimer's dementia risk, while estrogen plus progesterone, which you need if you have a uterus, showed a non-significant 23% reduction. Conversely, late life, meaning more than 10 years after menopause, use of both formulations was associated with an increased dementia risk, more so with estrogen plus progesterone than estrogen alone. Neither reached statistical significance. So her takeaway is starting estrogens during or soon after menopause could potentially cut down the risk of Alzheimer's and dementia among eligible women. While these findings don't directly translate to clinical advice, they sure shout out for more research in this area, she concludes. So, and to that, we say, amen. All of this research is super important. She has studies ongoing More brain scans show brain scan studies to see what happens when you do add estrogen into the system. We will cover that as it comes out. Awesome. Unfortunately, the issue, and you could see this coming because this is what always happens in the online space, many people are now seeing the message online that hormone therapy reduces your risk for Alzheimer's by a third and that you can't function without hormone therapy, which isn't really what all this shows, but we'll get to that in a moment. That is leaving a lot of women afraid not to take hormone therapy, and women who can't use it for whatever reason are feeling doomed. And my inbox is pretty full of despair from those latter women. And I'll be honest, I'm not immune to those feelings, though, as we'll discuss, this is all just far more nuanced than that, because the conversation has really on the online conversation has really narrowed in on hormones as the factor here, that our brains don't function without it. Without estrogen. But that's not really the takeaway. In fact, if you read Dr. Moscone's book, which I have, you'll see that hormone therapy is just one portion. She spends a lot of time talking about exercise and diet and estrogenic foods and supplements and stress. You know, she just dropped a study that chronic stress is implicated as a risk factor for Alzheimer's disease, which is really important for women because we report higher levels of stress than men. She also talks about the positive impacts of menopause, how she finds that women report being happier and more emotionally stable post-menopause, something I 100% attest to. Her first book was Brain Food. So there's a lot with nutrition that we can do here. Anyway, it's a long way to say that there are many, many factors that are getting lost. And this is important. It's really critical in all of this research to remember that relative risk and absolute risk are not the same thing. And it's just important to understand that difference in these conversations because what all this means to you personally depends on so many factors, including, of course, your personal risk and your genetic variants. I'll put links to all of the stuff that we have talked to in the show notes. To be super duper abundantly clear, none of this is me trying to persuade anyone to not use hormone therapy. If you need it and you can use it, you absolutely should. And even if you don't feel like you need it and you want it because you think that this is going to it's going to help you, I honestly think that that should be your choice too. I think that women should have lots of choice in this area. This is just me being my journalist self and adding context to a conversation which has taken on a life of its own online without the nuance it deserves and is leaving many women feeling scared when there's just more to talk about here than you see when you're scrolling through social media. And that happens all the time, right? So that's all the setup for the conversation. I just wanted to give you context about those studies because we talk about them so much. And I also wanted to share really quick before we get to it, a very cool, hopeful bit of news that I saw in the Alzheimer's research recently. Though the numbers of people living with the disease has been rising because, frankly, the number of women and men who are older is rising worldwide. The percentage of people coming down with dementia has steadily fallen across Europe and the US. In fact, research shows that the incidence has declined 20 to 25% over the past 3 decades in the US, UK, Sweden, and the Netherlands. Trying to figure out, like, sort of why they're seeing these declines in places that they're looking at, higher education in the treatment of vascular disease comes up. But a 75-year study that just dropped suggests that it may also be that our brains are actually bigger than they used to be. Participants born in the 70s had a 6.6% larger brain volume and almost 15% larger brain surface area than those born in the 30s. And the study author of this one is quoted as saying a larger brain structure represents a larger brain reserve and may buffer the late life effects of age-related brain diseases like Alzheimer's and related dementias. I thought that was an awesome study. I'll link that in the show notes too. Okay, so you know the drill. I'm not going to go into it all because I've talked a lot, but sign up for my free weekly newsletter at feistymenopause.com. While you're there, you can check out and join the wait list for the next Navigate Menopause course. We had a great first run. Next one will drop in May, so check that out. Check out the hormone series I'm doing with Dr. Carla DiGirolamo over at Feisty Women's Performance Podcast. And finally, thank you for all the lovely reviews and 5-star ratings that continue to come in. We work really hard here to try to bring you these nuanced conversations, and I just love you guys. So I've talked enough. A time for me to zip this up and get on with the show. Musculoskeletal health is everything during menopause. Everyone knows how much I love Joint Health Plus from Prevenex, which has helped me get back to distance running after arthritic toes stopped me in my tracks. Now they have a product that has become my go-to for muscle strength and recovery, Muscle Health Plus. Muscle Health Plus contains all the key ingredients we talk about on this show, like creatine monohydrate, essential amino acids, and branched-chain amino acids. Plus, even more cutting-edge ingredients like HMB and estrogen that are scientifically shown to increase muscle growth, recovery, and strength. I use it every day during my early morning lifting sessions, and there's no question that it helps my power during those workouts and my recovery after. Plus, I love having everything I need from the best high-quality ingredients in one reasonably priced shake. I've also heard from fellow users who have had bloating or GI upset in the past from creatine that haven't had any of that with Muscle Health Plus. I make my shake with almond milk and espresso, but it's also good with ice cold water, which makes the flavor really pop. As always, you can get 15% off your first order with the code HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. That's HIPPLAY, all caps, one word, at Prevenex.com. Do your muscles a favor and head on over and get some today. Okay, Sarah, I am so grateful for you for answering my call to come back on our show. For those who have not been listening since the beginning, I had on Dr. Sarah McKay way back. I mean, it might have been 2020. When did the book come in? You're
The
the
book was
women.
published, and this is important, 2018, early 2018. So the research in it is based on pretty much 2016, 17.
Yep.
So we've just put in a pitch to the publisher this week to update it. So it
So
was,
much
I
has
think it
happened.
was, I feel like it was sometime in COVID. So we'll say sometime in
Yeah, no, I
2020.
started the show in 2020, and you were one of the very early episodes. I mean, you were definitely in the top 20. So
Oh, good. An OG.
I am so excited to have you back. And I'm just going to come right out of the gate and say, like, I myself and many others in my community right now, in this moment, despite, and I'm only going to speak for myself right now, but I've heard this from others, I feel happier and more mentally and emotionally stable probably than I ever have in my life now that I'm, now that I'm post-menopause, and despite that, Sarah, I am walking around so many waking moments of every single day wondering if I am doing my brain a disservice by not going on hormone therapy in my midlife because I'm paving the way for dementia if I don't take it. And I'm not alone. I know I'm not alone. And it's maddening.
I think in the last, when I wrote my book, I sometimes say, even when my book came out in 2018, menopause hadn't been invented. I mean, of course it was,
Totally. Yeah.
hadn't been invented. And I say that lightly. It wasn't a topic of conversation. Even the last 5 years, even the last 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, the conversation has gone from, if we're talking specifically around talking about hormone therapy for menopause, it's gone from fear and avoidance to FOMO. It's like anything does these days, we're either frothing at one side or the other. There's no happy medium. You're either, at one end or the other. And it's almost as if, and I literally wrote a newsletter email yesterday that I sent out, and I think I said something like, women have gone from, fear and avoidance to FOMO, from going, there's no way I'm going to take hormone therapy because it might give me dementia, to maybe I should, I wonder if it will help prevent dementia, to where you're at, if I don't take it, I will get dementia. And that conversation has gone within the course of a year or two. But the same could be said if you had concerns about heart disease or mental health issues. It's almost as if we were scared about taking this, and there were valid reasons for that after 2002 with the Women's Health Study and the problems within that. Everyone became very, very scared. There's been a whole lot of re-education, et cetera, more science, more studies done, more statistical analysis. So it's become clear when it's a great idea to take menopause hormone therapy, what the risks and the benefits are. But it's now, and I will say it is the online conversation. It is not the menopause societies. It is not clinical practice guidelines. It is not the science. It is even the most, the book that has just come out in the last few days. We have a terrible cover here in Australia.
No, our cover's nicer. Our cover's much more beautiful.
Yeah, your cover's much prettier.
Yeah, I have it right here. Way prettier.
Even in Lisa Moscone's book, despite what you hear on social media, there is careful, thoughtful language and caution and discussion.
In her book, there is.
On social media, it is different.
Yep.
So where are you getting your information from? What are you tuning into? If you are tuning into social media, you are getting the froth that they're very, you're getting the extremes. I see this on my social media. If I post a reasoned, thoughtful, cogent reel of me having a discussion, no one cares. If I post something that is a really, really hot topic with a little bit of a take, whatever way, it garners more likes. I'm not saying that the messages are out there because people are following the social media algorithms, but the algorithms are following us and we are receiving information from social media, and that's not necessarily the same information that's being provided by the cautious, careful menopause societies, clinical practice guidelines, maybe even people's doctors. That's not to say there's not room for conversation, and there absolutely should be room for conversation. And when we look at data of tens of thousands of people, we want to make that meaningful to us. So there's research and there's research, but that's really what having a really good healthcare provider, we call it a GP. I've got an excellent GP. Sometimes she can be a wee bit not formidable. She's a very tall Eastern European lady. She's very pragmatic and always says, don't think too much about this stuff. She says, you think too much and you'll think yourself in or out of anything. She understands the power of the mind. So there's almost competing conversations out there. So you may be getting messages that if you don't take HRT right now, you will get Alzheimer's disease, but that's not what the careful, cautious conversations that are informed by science are saying.
So it's,
and we can
what's it,
get into what
yeah.
those conversations are.
Oh yeah,
are.
No, we're definitely going to get into those conversations.
And I know what you're talking about because I'm on social media too. Yeah. I have been part of some of these extreme conversations. Just a couple of weeks ago, I had my Instagram account reported to Instagram and threatened with suspension if I continued to comment on a certain profile who was flogging HRT and saying we shouldn't even be considering a biopsychosocial approach. We shouldn't be considering taking a holistic approach to menopause. And I was receiving messages from Instagram saying your comments are being deleted and you'll be suspended if you continue. And I was advocating a biopsychosocial approach. So radical, so dangerous. So we just have to be aware that when the conversations are happening, they are very, very different depending on where that is happening, that conversation.
And that's part of, you know, for people like myself and yourself, you know, but I really straddle that world between sitting at the Menopause Society meetings and like the media, right? Like I sit like right in that place. And it's interesting, Sarah, because you mentioned heart disease, and that certainly is another very big part of this conversation. But with heart disease, we can check so many metrics. I can know my ApoB. I can get a scan. Yeah. I got a scan. I can, so many things. I can get pictures. I can know. But up here between the ears and the black box,
it's
up here,
it's
much more like, I feel great. Everything's good now. My mind works. I never really brain fog, but still I'm like, I don't know. I haven't had those brain scans. I don't know what's going
on. Brain health is an underserved area of health and medicine, and that's because it's really hard to study a brain. And neuroscience has lagged. Women's health, you add women's health to any of these conversations, and it's automatically understudied and underserved. However, I'm the eternal optimist, and we know this now, and we're working towards filling those gaps. I don't spend too much time wallowing around in the misery of, oh, women have been underserved, and men, we know more about men's health. Yep. We do. We're moving towards changing that. Okay, it's shit. but we're making it better. Lagging behind. Cardiovascular health. I mean, you could be, you know, cynical and say, well, that's because it affects so many men. We've got so much research on it, and we do. So you can test all of these metrics and get all of these things checked out. And something like a heart attack is so dramatic and so life-ending in many situations that we want to do everything we can to prevent it. Whereas something like dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and I'll define them in a moment, kind of creeps up on you quietly. And often it's people in their 90s. We're not getting people in their 50s dropping dead from dementia overnight.
Right.
So it's kind of like, seems to be, oh, well, is there a bit of ageism in there? There's, you know, and there's lots of little things to do. There's 100 things we can do to pull and twist levers, whereas heart disease is a bit more discreet. Just in terms of dementia and Alzheimer's disease, and it's quite important because when it comes to studies that are done, there is a difference. So dementia is like a big umbrella term which describes symptoms of, you know, forgetfulness and personality change and kind of the progressive inability to kind of function as you used to be able to. Sitting under that are lots and lots of diseases of the brain, brain aging diseases, of which dementia is an enormous symptom. So if we look at all of dementia, Alzheimer's disease, depending on which country's statistics you look at, is about sort of 60 to 70%. Alzheimer's disease makes up 60 to 70% of cases of people with dementia. There are other dementias, frontotemporal dementia, Lewy body dementia, and then there's lots and lots and lots of other types of dementias. Of Alzheimer's disease, there's a definite preponderance for women to be more likely to be diagnosed with men. And there's a higher risk for women. Men still get Alzheimer's disease, and actually men's rates are starting to catch up a little bit too. But if you look at other types of dementia, frontotemporal dementia, actually men are more likely to be diagnosed with that type of dementia because it's kind of a vascular problem. And there appears to be more of a risk if you're male. And my apologies, I use the words male and man and woman and female interchangeably when I'm talking about health and medicine, because we're just going to go with the shorthand because it makes life easier. Yeah. As a science communicator, I'm not trying to exclude any particular groups here. So when we're talking about dementia and when we're talking about Alzheimer's disease, we need to be, and this is because I'm a neuroscientist and I need to be clear and precise if I'm going to make comment. We need to be thinking, are we talking about reducing the risk of dementia symptoms, for example, this kind of extreme cognitive decline you might see in someone aging? Or are we specifically looking at reducing the risk of the disease of dementia with its particular neuropathology? So broadly speaking, the conversations aren't making a differentiation between them, but the science will be making a differentiation between them. And sometimes a study might include dementia, all kinds of dementia. Some studies might only include Alzheimer's disease. So you've got a different group here.
The conversation about hormones, and correct me, please, if I'm wrong, does seem to be about Alzheimer's when we're talking about, like, Lisa Moscone's book that she's talking about, are not necessarily?
No, not necessarily. Because, okay. There's one paper you can go and have a look. Sometimes the papers specifically themselves will define what they're talking about. And sometimes they talk about, there's a phrase they use. I might be ADOD, which I think
all,
is that
like
something
all cause
disease and other dementias.
Oh, I didn't mention. Yeah. And her systematic review, together. You're correct.
Yeah.
Is
so
Alzheimer's
there's different
disease and dementia. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it's, yeah. So not that entirely matters for the conversation more broadly, but it does matter if we're going to be talking about statistics and risk and
right.
things like that.
Right. So let's talk about,
excuse me.
No problem. Let's talk about estrogen and its relationship here. You yourself did a little carousel about estrogen in the brain, because that seems to be the conversation, like that's the underlying fuel that is firing up this conversation right now, is like our understanding of estrogen in the brain. So
yeah.
Maybe start there.
And it's a super interesting one, but I think just to kind of take a step back
Yes.
and put my kind of take on the world,
Please.
we can call it a biopsychosocial approach, but my model is always you've got the brain in the middle, and you've got your bottom-up body, you've got your biology, all the signals that are coming up from your body, which includes hormones, but includes everything from feeling hungry to your bone density. Your brain interacts with your bone to get a read on bone density, to do I need to, I've got an achy back, through to, the nutrients that are coming in from your food, your genes, everything. So everything biological. Then we've got the outside world coming in through our senses. We interact with the world directly through our senses, through our visual sense, through hearing, smell, touch, and taste. My smell, anyone will be able to hear me. I sound a bit clogged up. My smell's a bit useless at the moment. I've got a bit of a cold. And then we've got our top down. We've got our, what we could call it, psychology. We can call it mind. Thoughts, feelings, expectations, they also influence, a sort of a state of the brain at any one moment in time. So if we're kind of talking about, we've got all of these data signals coming in from all of these places that the brain is kind of making meaning of and processing and then telling us what to do next, whether that be sweat because you're hot or stand up and move into another room because you can hear your kid complaining about their homework and they need help, or I don't know, like move and stretch your body because your back's aching, or start feeling tearful because you're looking at a really emotional news on your phone. So essentially your brain is making meaning of a lot of data that's coming in from a lot of different sources, and all that's going is what should I do next? And that could be physiological or behavioral, or it could be some sort of thought. So when we're talking about, what all these different signals are, one of these signals, one of the billions of signals that's coming in are of course our hormones. When we're here having these conversations about menopause, it's probably best just to talk about estrogen. We can also talk about progesterone,
I would
but we
love
don't
to.
know as much. We don't know as much about progesterone in terms of the adult human brain, as we know about estrogen. Now, you wanted me to talk you through this post. I'm just scrolling through my own Instagram here to have a look at this post.
Yeah, it was really just a post about the estrogen in the brain, and you don't have to go through the post exactly, but it was, it's part of this conversation about menopause, hormone therapy, and cognitive health.
So when we go and you to talk about menopause, you've got to go all the way back through puberty. So there is a constant conversation that kind of starts off in puberty between our brains and our ovaries. And there's conversations between our brain, as everything from our brains to our bones, from our brains to our gut. Depends on who you are, where you think the conversation is most important to tune into. But we'll just tune into that brain ovarian conversation. And everyone's gone through puberty, we all kind of know what happens, and your menstrual cycles kick in and they eventually become reasonably regular. Recently learned that, cycles are actually a lot long. They average about 30 days in your teens and kind of get much shorter on average by the time you're kind of in your 40s, which I thought was kind of, there's this lovely graph you can see of menstrual cycle length getting shorter. So kind of as we go through all of our reproductive years, there's this conversation. And we'll all be familiar from high school science, or if you've schooled yourself up beyond school, like I think most people should, and not rely only on what they were or were not taught in high school, that the hort that the sort of the estrogen and the progesterone hormones kind of go up and down. Depend, as an egg ripens in your ovaries, you release more estrogen that stimulates the ovulation. Hopefully, you'll get pregnant if you want to, or not if you don't. And that estrogen doesn't just kind of hang around in the ovaries, it goes all throughout the body through puberty. It causes the development of secondary sex characteristics like breasts, etc. But it also goes up into our brain. And our brain, like a lot of organs in our body, has receptors for estrogen. Neurons in our brain, cells all throughout our body have receptors for all kinds of hormones, for all kinds of molecules, because that is one of the ways in which our body use our cells in our body communicate with each other through molecular signals. There's our nervous system signals, whereby we've got nerves directly inputting and, sending signals, but we've also got hormones and other molecules which go through our body. So there's all of these constant kind of feedback loops and conversations, and everything's kind of modulating everything else in a positive or a negative feedback loop. So in our brain, we've got estrogen signals, and there's different parts of the brain we can zone in on and look at, well, what's the effect of estrogen? And particularly over the course of like a menstrual cycle, we see estrogen kind of going up or down or up or down. We'll set pregnancy and the pill aside for a minute because they're different physiological states. But if we zoom in on like a individual neuron in the brain, like a brain cell, and it has like, it looks like a little tree. It's got lots of branches, and the branches are called dendrites, and they receive inputs from other neurons. And the inputs come in on like little buds on the tree, synapses, or we call them sort of dendritic spines. So if you imagine a twig in spring that's got all the little buds coming off it, they all start to flourish. Well, if we look in at one part of the brain, the hippocampus, and this is work done by this amazing scientist, Catherine Woolley, kind of in the sort of 90s, quite, late. Estrogen kind of causes the rise and the fall of estrogen causes the flourishing and the retraction of these little synapses. So that we can see this direct physical modulation of the brain physically by estrogen. Over the years, we've kind of come out, we've zoomed back, and we're looking to see how does do all of the networks in the brain interact. If we were like looking at a brain scan, how do we see kind of different networks in the brain change during the course of the menstrual cycle? I mean, there's not really a good clear story about that yet. One thing that we're pretty sure of, one of the kind of the most well-established conversations is between a region of the brain called the hypothalamus and the ovaries. And that's essentially a very tight feedback loop that controls ovulation and controls the menstrual cycle. So when the estrogen reaches the hypothalamus, it then sends a signal back down to the ovaries via the pituitary gland, via hormone signals. Okay, you've ovulated now, kind of settle down and either prepare for pregnancy or prepare for the next menstrual cycle. So that's quite a tight conversation, that one. And that's the one that changes significantly during perimenopause. Because what happens during perimenopause is our eggs start getting old, and it's driven by old eggs. And they don't, sometimes you might get three. That's why the later you get pregnant in chronological age, sometimes the more multiple births there are. So the older your eggs get, the more kind of fickle they get. And so sometimes you might get a whole lot of estrogen released from the ovaries, and the next month you might not get much. That's because you get a whole lot of estrogen released from the ovaries. There's all of this estrogen going up to the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is going, whoa, calm down, stop shouting. And the ovaries go, oh, okay, sorry, and quieten down. And then the next month there's not much. And then the hypothalamus is going, can't hear you, can't hear you. So it's this like crazy conversation. Instead of this nice, tight, regulated conversation, it becomes all chaotic. And all of that chaos of the estrogen, just simply caused by a chaotic feedback loop, then has all of these knock-on effects on other parts of kind of our physiology. So sometimes you've got sky-high estrogen, sometimes hardly any. And what we know from puberty, from prep, especially pregnant, especially postnatal, those first few hours, days, and weeks, is when hormones are kind of irregular, that's when there's a bit more vulnerability kind of in the system. It's not so much when it's kind of tracking regularly. In women who have extreme PMS, like diagnosed PMDD, again, it's the shift in the hormones that often cause the sort of the overall instability in the system. In terms of menopause symptoms, the most well-established that we understand neurally, and this is my favorite one because it's got a clear process and I like it when the biology makes sense. That's why I became a neurobiologist, because I like it when the mechanisms are clear. And I've got a post coming out on this soon. In our hypothalamus, it receives the estrogen signals. There's a thermostat which detects how hot or cool our body is, and it's sort of set so that if we start getting a bit hot, we sweat and we want to take our clothes off, our blood vessels dilate. We start to behave in ways to cool ourselves down. We open a window, we go outside, whatever. So there's a physiological response from our body, and then there is a behavioral response. Same if we get too cold, we'll shiver and then we'll start to put more clothes on, and we might put heating on or something. So there's a physiological and a behavioral response in all mammals. During menopause or during perimenopause, with all the crazy estrogen, the thermostat kind of gets a bit narrower. So your body temperature hasn't altered, but the top level of the thermostat is like really easily triggered by just a slight increase in body temperature. And your body temperature is going up a little bit, and your hypothalamus is going, oh, it's hot, it's hot, it's hot. And it's almost like it's kind of gone panic stations. And so it tries to get rid of as much heat as possible. You weren't necessarily hot, but it's telling your body you are. So your body is behaving in a way as if you are hot. So it sends all your blood to your skin to throw the heat off, and you start sweating, and it's quite sudden. It's like an emergency response. And that's why you suddenly get these hot flashes. Same at night, but night makes things more complicated because you're asleep. So you've got the physiological response, but you might not have the behavioral response. And so then your body goes, we've got to wake this person up. So they behave in a way to also cool themselves down. So then often women wake up with quite a jolt because there's been an adrenaline kind of surge through their body, kicked off by their hypothalamus to wake them up. And they've gone, oh gosh, okay, throw the covers off. Try and cool down. What happens is you cool down and then you fall asleep and then you get hot, cold. And so then you wake up. So then you put the covers on and it goes through that. And so then your sleep is becoming disrupted. So we've got what's going on during the day, what's going on at night. We know it's to do with estrogen. You put estrogen back in the system with hormone therapy, it controls those vasomotor symptoms. It makes the hot flashes more manageable during the day. At night, hopefully your sleep is less disturbed. What happens if you get disturbed sleep? But you've got a domino effect.
So then where does the actual changes in the brain come? Because you've seen the brain remodeling research and the
So this
glucose.
is,
Okay, go
yeah.
ahead.
So this is in terms of what's happening in the hypothalamus and hot flashes in sleep. So there's that story's quite well established. That what happens next after sleep is anyone's guess, because that could be brain fog, that could be mood disorders, that could be insomnia, that could be why when some women with insomnia start taking menopause hormone therapy, their sleep does not improve because it's become established as a psychological issue. And I'm not saying that in a dismissive way.
No, I get it.
Good sleep. The one thing that sets you up for a great workout and a good day is quality sleep. We talk about it all the time here on the show, which is why I'm stoked to have Lagoon Sleep as a new sponsor. Because one of the most overlooked tools in a great sleep toolbox is the thing you literally rest your head on 8 hours a night, your pillow. A quality pillow is everything. Otherwise, you end up tossing, turning, punching, and folding your pillow, waking up with neck pain, and all the stuff that happens when your pillow doesn't meet your personal comfort needs. Say hello to the most comfortable sleep you've ever had with Lagoon. They start you out with a 2-minute personalized pillow quiz and then pair you with your perfect pillow. I got the Otter, a cooling adjustable pillow that is perfect for side sleepers who run warm at night like I do. It is a dream. It's fully adjustable, so I was able to get the perfect loft and support. And the cooling feature is everything. As someone who turned into a furnace every evening before menopause, I appreciate that the Otter is stuffed with shredded gel-infused memory foam, which instead of trapping heat from my neck and head, draws it away and dissipates it. It's truly delightful. I'm a good sleeper, and Otter has taken it to the next level with both support and cooling. Put my head down, good night, Irene. My Oura Ring confirms what little tossing and turning I was doing is gone. The beauty of the pillow quiz is you can get the perfect pillow that you need to and make your sleep the best sleep you can have. Go to lagoonsleep.com/hitplay and take the 2-minute quiz to find your perfect match, and then use the code HITPLAY, all caps one word, for 15% off your first purchase. Sweet dreams.
For decades, running shoes have been researched, tested, and designed for men. Brands have relied on the shrink it and pink it approach to sell male shoes to female customers. That's why we are stoked to be working with Hedas. Hedas designs athletic footwear for women that elevates performance, safety, and style. Hedas has unlocked the science behind women's biomechanics through dedicated research and creates better shoes for women's performance. Some of Hedas' special features include a lower ankle collar to reduce rubbing on women's ankle bones, a breathable mesh toe box to allow for ventilation and accommodate female toe shape, a more narrow and reductive heel cup to reduce heel slippage and take pressure off the Achilles, a rounded instep that creates a snug fit through the middle to match the curvature of a woman's foot, and supercritical foam and a PVEX plate in the midsole to keep our legs going when the going gets tough.
Hedis has 3 shoe models designed for different sessions: the Alma Cruise for your long runs, the Alma Tempo for training days, and the Alma Speed for pushing the pace. I've been running in the Alma Tempos, and they are a pleasure to train in. You can get your own pair of Hedis at Hedis.com and use the code FEISTY20, that's all caps, FEISTY20, for 20% off. Check it out today. We'll put a clickable link in the show notes to make it a snap. Okay, then, so can we really dig into what that brain remodeling research by Dr. Lisa Moscone really shows?
Yeah. So in the 2021 paper, which was the first paper published looking at how brains change during menopause.
That was the big one. It's the seminal one.
We're a bit slow, but we're getting there.
Yeah.
So in this, they scanned women's brains sort of pre-menopause, perimenopause, and then post-menopause. So they've got, I mean, there's not a lot of women in this study. We're not looking at thousands of brains. We're looking at kind of 50 or so brains. Some were on hormone therapy, some weren't. But overall, what they saw with the gray matter, so that's kind of the wrinkly gray coating on the outside of the brain, they saw during perimenopause, there was a sort of a slight volume reduction, but then that kind of plumped up again, that recovered and was actually slightly thicker post-menopause. So there's a reorganization. It sort of goes down and then it goes all the way back up again, which I think is really interesting. White matter volume kind of went slowly down, but we do tend to see that slow decline anyway as we're kind of aging. So that's hard to sort of differentiate, but there's a reorganization and then a very significant recovery of gray matter volume post-menopause. And this is what's really interesting, is that the graphs that you see are sort of showing pre, peri, post menopause, and they kind of, there's a change and then it kind of flatlines. So the brain kind of reorganizes and then resettles into this new kind of way of being, which could be like the second half of your life if you're lucky. And we see the same with pregnancy, and we see the same with puberty. These are significant neurological transitions, reorganization of the brain, and then the brain kind of settles down for the next kind of phase of life. In terms of the metabolism, that's interesting, because we see, as in every cell in our body, when we go through menopause, we see kind of a lesser efficiency in brain metabolism of glucose. So our brain's incredibly energetic, needs a lot of nutrients, and needs a lot of glucose and a lot of oxygen to work well. So it gets slightly less efficient at metabolizing glucose. However, it's very adaptable and responsive, and so it kind of ups its production of ATP. It kind of counteracts that by kind of upping its metabolism kind of output, so to speak. So what we see is this kind of reorganization and then kind of a leveling out and a settling down, which is what we see in hormones. We see this roller coastering of hormones, and then they kind of stabilize and flatline. And women will report this time of life, whether it be due to hormones or just like the stuff that goes on when you're in your late 40s, there's a lot going on, and then things kind of level out a little bit later.
Do we know what any of this means for our Alzheimer's disease and or dementia risk?
Gosh, so risk is is quite a complicated issue.
Maybe we should include that in there too, what actual we're talking about when we say risk.
So if we look at Alzheimer's disease only, because dementia includes different dementias, some of which men are more at risk. So let's just look at Alzheimer's disease only. We know once we get through to our 80s and 90s, there are more total number of women versus men that are diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. And even if we kind of go, well, it's not because women live longer than men, because the biggest risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease is getting older. Even accounting for slightly longer lives in women than men, there's still reasons why women are more likely to be diagnosed. And if we kind of look through the lifespans of people who are in their 80s and 90s, and we look at all of the various risk factors that kind of tip things one way or another, especially women and men in the 80s and 90s right now probably led quite different lives in their teenage years and 20s and 30s. So we have experiences of gender that we're carrying and different kind of lives lived. And that increases and decreases risks of different diseases. you know, back in the sort of the 20s, 30s and 40s, lots of men smoked and drank and they went to war and it was very, very stressful, which has kind of meant they're more likely to develop heart disease than women. So, you know, these lifetimes of risk that we're carrying through. So we've got, you know, gendered experiences, but we've also got our biological sex, which appears to be kind of making women more vulnerable. Now, is this due to the menopause? And this really is the big question. Perhaps one of the risk factors is kind of this reduction in hormones. But it's really, really difficult when you've got a disease like Alzheimer's disease, because we're very, very clear on what a lot of the risk factors are. And we've got, it's almost like, you know, you've got like those old fashioned scales you'll see in those markets. And we've got kind of risk factors on one side, which make you more likely to get a disease, and protective factors on the other. And it's very hard to clear everything out and only look at the hormones, because we're looking at things like education. We're looking at things like how intellectually engaged were you in your job, your social economic status, which is a really, really important, perhaps one of the most important. Poverty is one of the greatest risk factors. We're looking at, you know, your diet through your lifespan. We're looking at your hormone status, your reproductive history, and that's going to include how many babies you carried, whether you breastfed or not. It also looks at your oral contraceptive use, your hormone contraceptive use. We're looking at whether you've had a head injury or not. We're looking at risks of mental health. Depression is a strong risk factor. Hearing loss is a strong risk factor. So, you know, we've got all of these experiences which are tipping the scales in our favor one way or another. But it's almost as if suddenly someone's come along and put hormones, and that's like the biggest, heaviest weight, and that's the only one. It outweighs everything else. And that's simply not the case. Because if we look at the data very, very carefully, and we start looking at risk factors, we start looking at relative risk, absolute risk, percentages, statistics, everything is kind of, you know, will increase your risk slightly or decrease your risk slightly. Hormones aren't this big heavy weight that's suddenly tipping it. We're still trying to figure out exactly its weight, if that makes sense.
So then please, in this way, speak to me about relative and absolute risk. When we hear from the meta-analysis that's out that HT, estrogen only, reduces dementia risk by 30%. And then people will hear that will decrease my risk by 30%, which makes people go, I must get on hormones now. And they also then hear that EPT, which is estrogen and progesterone, will reduce the risk by 23%, which in the paper is non-significant, but people don't hear that as non-significant. So what does all this mean?
The studies that have been done looking at the risk of developing dementia or Alzheimer's disease, or sometimes the two together, looking at hormone therapy use, are complicated to make sense of, because we have women included in those studies who started taking hormone therapy at different times in their menopause transition or much later in life. The Women's Health Study were enrolling women in their 60s, 70s, and 80s. We've got women nowadays who are taking hormone therapy in the perimenopause. And we think that there's probably a window of opportunity. Some people don't like to talk about the window of opportunity, but there's probably a time in life in which it's perhaps healthier to start. So we've got women starting at different ages. We've got women taking menopause hormone therapy for different lengths of time. Some women for a year. We might have women now who are going to take it for 30 years, but we don't know what's going to happen to them, because we've got to wait until they're in their 80s and 90s to see. So we've got that kind of muddling the story up. We've got different women taking different types of estrogen, some women taking the kind of the more old-fashioned standard type of a pill. And we know that if you take estrogen as a pill, it gets metabolized by your liver first. So it has different effects on your body than if you're taking it straight through the skin. We've got different sort of molecular formulations of estrogen. We've got women who have perhaps been on the pill, the oral contraceptive pill, for 5 years, 10 years, 25, 30 years. So we've also got that hormone history as well. So there's a lot of kind of, you know, data in there that's skewing information one way or another. But when these meta-analyses get done, essentially they pull together all of this data and then they kind of look to see what increased risk or decreased risk. And a meta-analysis will always report this particular number called relative risk, or RR. And if you've got a relative risk of one, it means your risk is not increased or decreased. If you've got a risk kind of below one, like 0.7 or 0.8 or whatever, it means your risk has kind of gone down slightly. And if you've got a risk of 1.1 or 2 or 3 or 4 or 5, it's gone up slightly. So that's what those numbers mean. But relative risk means nothing because it's just comparing two groups within a study. It says nothing about your personal risk. What you need to understand is we absolutely must absolutely focus on absolute risk. I always say that, absolutely absolute risk, because that's the personal risk to you. So you need to know what your personal risk is of developing dementia and then make decisions based on what these relative risks are telling us of a whole population. So I'm 50 next year. What is my risk of developing dementia before I die? Say I live to 90. Say 10% absolute risk of developing dementia. That means if there were 100 versions of me, by the time I'm 90, 10 of me will develop the condition. So I've got a 10% chance. 10 out of 100 of me will get Alzheimer's disease. Let's introduce the treatment, hormone therapy. There's a 30% relative risk decrease in developing dementia if I choose to take hormone therapy now and I take the right formulation at the right time for me, which we're not entirely sure what that is. That means that there's a 30% reduction in my 10% risk. So a 30% reduction doesn't lower my risk massively. It reduces it by 30% of the 10%. So it's kind of taken it down to like 7% instead of 10%. So right. That means if there were 100 versions of me, 10 of me would get dementia and not on hormone therapy. And if I take it, 7 of me will get it. So there's 3 less people. But that's exactly what 30% relative risk is.
If I can be blunt, and I'm going to be, what actually upsets me about this in the presentation that's out there right now is that this is the same kind of presentation of risk that the WHI got crucified for doing, right? Like, taking relative risk and making it sound absolute.
Yeah.
And I'm not
we've got data showing 80% increased risk of, say, developing, if you're a teenage girl, you've got an 80% increased risk of developing depression if you're on the oral contraceptive pill. But over the course of a year, if you've got a 10% absolute risk of developing, that just means you're going, you know, you've got 10 girls going up to 18 girls out of 100. So 80% risk doesn't mean 80% of
people.
It's the percentage of your absolute risk. So you have to know what your absolute risk is. Now, if you have a genetic predisposition of developing Alzheimer's disease, your mum had it at 60, your dad had it, your aunts have it, you've got a clear genetic mutation that's causing that, then your risk is entirely different to someone who's perhaps, you know, ticked off all of the lifestyle factors as a preventative and is fit and healthy and intellectually engaged and, you know, of high socioeconomic status and does all the right. Your risk is your absolute, your kind of baseline risk is different.
Yeah.
And this is the problem, is all of these communications that are going out there should absolutely report absolute risk. And that's a fundamental role of health, public health, and of health communications. And people that are doing good health communications and science communications know this. So if you're just hearing this, oh, it'll reduce your risk by 30%, and no one's explaining the difference between relative and absolute risk, just go, okay, what am I making of that?
Yes.
But no one understands this. And this is what happens if we get our information only from social media.
Yeah.
We're not getting information from the organizations and the societies that spend all day long wallowing around in absolute and relative risk and statistical percentages. Because we've also got data here that's saying, oh, well, there's a decreased risk, but it's not statistically significant. People go, I don't really care about stats. I don't know what that means. All that means is that the data is not strong enough to say, well, that's not, it could be due to chance. It's probably not due to chance because it's a similar pattern that we're seeing between different types of hormone therapies. But when we're saying it's not significant, it means we can't say that with any certainty based on the data that we have.
Right.
And that's the information that the menopause societies and the clinical practice guidelines are basing their recommendations on. They have to base their recommendations on the best data that we have to this point in time. And that's why good, clear science communications often have like, they might have, and this is what they all should be doing, they have like little arrays of like little stick figures of ladies. And, you know, some of them are colored, you might have 10 of them colored in saying these 10 out of 100 are at risk of Alzheimer's disease. You put hormone therapy in, you might have 7 of those 100. And when people see that, they gain a visual representation and it makes the numbers more, puts them in context.
Yeah.
And it means that people can then make kind of meaning of them because no one's a statistician.
Yeah, no.
No one's an epidemiologist, but we've got people on social media throwing these numbers out. And then we've got people taking that information, going to their doctor saying, well, it will decrease my risk of dementia. My mum had dementia. I have to have hormone therapy. And the doctor's going, well, okay, well, I can only base my recommendations on these clinical practice guidelines I've got in front of me. It's not because someone hates women. It's because we've got these kind of clash. We've got advocacy clashing up against science almost in a way. And I'm all for hormone therapy. Like, you know, took the oral contraceptive pill. I hand that out like lollies. I took that for 30 years. I like a bit of hormones. It doesn't matter whether they're synthetic or bioidentical or whatever. Great, I've functioned perfectly well on them and I've been very happy and clearly cognitively able. We've got to understand that there's not a conspiracy here where we've got the advocates versus the scientists. What we're trying to do is understand the data and make the strongest, clearest recommendations that we can. Lisa Moscone is making the same recommendations in her book as the Menopause Society. She's cautious and she's careful. And what she's saying and what I'm saying and what all the recommendations are saying are there's a whole lot going on in midlife. There's a whole lot more to midlife than hormone therapy. You know, there's your social world. There's the world out there that may be stressing you or not. How's that, how are you responding to the people around you? How are you responding to the stress of life? What's your physical health, your physiological, your cardiovascular health like? Your bone health? What's your diet like? What's your exercise like? You know, what's your sleep like? How well are you managing that? There are so many levers that we can pull and push and, you know, or little weights that we can put on our scales. Hormone therapy is not the only weight and it's not the biggest, heaviest weight. It's just one weight. We're just trying to figure out how heavy or light it is right now.
That's a great way to put it. And yeah. I have a question, of a couple of questions, but my first one is, do we know why when you add the P to the E, you know, why the benefit seems to, like, you know, what happens there? You know, because so much of the conversation, which also makes me bananas, by the way, so much of the conversation about all the benefits almost exclusively will pump up the estrogen benefits, but they don't talk about the, you know, the E plus P, which almost always has a different effect. And I don't know if that's because it's progestins or we don't have enough on micronized progesterone, but what's
this
happening?
Is interesting. Yeah. Because the data is showing, so people are clear, if it's estrogen only, we're seeing a lot more benefits than we're seeing if it's estrogen and progesterone or progesterone. And you have to take both, if you still have a uterus, if you haven't had a hysterectomy, if you don't take the progesterone with the estrogen only kind of causes your endometrium to keep growing and growing, and it can eventually cause endometrial cancer. Now, the absolute lifetime risk of endometrial cancer is about 4%. So is the, you know, we're taking that into account. No one is saying you shouldn't be taking the progesterone if you've still got a you've still got a uterus in place. Functional is perhaps the wrong word to use. So the strongest benefits we're seeing are in women who've taken estrogen only, who were able to, perhaps because they've had a full hysterectomy, or perhaps they've got a marina in place, or perhaps they were they had a full hysterectomy, including their ovaries out, and then they were put on estrogen only, perhaps in their mid-40s. So again, we're not saying to women, well, you're going to get the benefits of estrogen, but you've got to have a hysterectomy first. We can't make that as a guideline. I mean, that's, we're not going to do unnecessary surgery because the risks of that are going to be way, way higher for everyone. So again, we're getting a lot of focusing on the benefits for some people and almost trying to make them a blanket statement for everyone. And that's not necessarily the case. We don't exactly know what's the interaction here. Is the synthetic versions of progesterone different from the micronized bio body identical, mm-hmm. whatever the language is, progestogen? We don't know yet, because if there's an ideal formulation and we've got all the women on it now who are 50, we've got to wait 30 or 40 years to find out what's going to happen to them.
Do we know just in general, like why it might blunt some of these benefits that we see?
I don't know off the top of my head, and I looked briefly, and it appears to be a little bit like we're not entirely sure there's something going on there, because most of the focus has been on, when I wrote my first book, I don't know whether I said in it, but I wanted to have a look, what do we know about progesterone? Where are the receptors? What's happening in the brain? And it was all estrogen. There wasn't much on there, so we might not even know yet. But it's clear what the outcomes are in some women. So the story's way is super complicated.
Yeah.
It's not just take HRT and you won't get Alzheimer's. It's not. If it was, that would be the recommendation, but no one can make that recommendation yet, because we do see increased risks in some instances.
And do we know, when I sit back and go to these sessions and read these papers and have these conversations, you know, I'm also reminded of Dr. Thurston's work, Rebecca Thurston's work, about like the women with higher symptomology, especially like night sweats at night. We don't know exactly why, but they have more of these white matter hypertensities and all this stuff. So, and exactly. If you have like, if you're very symptomatic, you have a higher risk for cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's. It makes sense to me that people who would be taking hormone therapy would have a lot of symptoms, because that's why they're going to their doctor. So maybe we're seeing this benefit because we're seeing at-risk women getting help, but we can't say that necessarily either, right? I don't know.
Exactly. So women are selecting in.
Yes.
The women are selecting in to get the hormone therapy. They're self-selecting because they're more symptomatic. And are we now going to see more women self-selecting in because they keep getting told that if they don't take, you know, I said it's gone from fear to FOMO, if they don't take it. So now, and at the moment, the guidelines are clear. It's a really good treatment if you are symptomatic. And my GP has brought this up with me without me even bringing it up with her. She said, we know a whole lot more now. If your symptoms become disruptive to your day-to-day life, then we can have conversations about how we're going to approach this. And it depends whether you've got still having periods or not. And this is the thing. And then this whole, and the idea, so if you've got women who are having a lot more hot flashes, and that for some women is very stressful, and other women are like, oh, whatever, I don't really mind. And, you know, your approach to that matters too, despite the pushback on using CBT as a way of dealing with hot flashes. CBT doesn't make the hot flashes non-existent, and it's not saying they are in your head. It's just giving you another means in which to think about them and approach them. Are they really stressful to me, or are they not? At night, we don't know whether it is the hot flash per se that is causing more white matter hyperintensities in a brain, or, you know, what's the cause and what's the effect? It's a correlation.
Right.
Is it the actual hot flash, or is it the fact that we're being woken up? It's hard to say, because when it comes to a brain, there's always a feedback loop. And all we can say is there's a correlation. To check out causation, what we need to be doing is we need to go back and be doing the basic animal studies, because women aren't going to be giving their brains to science when they're still alive for us to have a wee look at and chop up and look under the microscope. No, we've got to be doing, and it's really hard to do really good science because there's so, so many variables in here. So when we say it's hard to say, it is because there are a lot of variables, and it's hard to make clear statements of this causes that.
It sure is. So let's bring this back into estrogen. I believe in your Instagram post, you mentioned it's neuroprotective as well.
Broadly speaking,
okay,
the more estrogen you've experienced in your life,
yep,
the more protected your, estrogen has a neuroprotective effect.
Okay.
So it's kind of on the healthy side of that scale. But mm-hmm. as I said, we don't know how heavy it is. And if we kind of do look at older brains of people, and then we kind of look back across their lifespan and get them to say, what's happened to you through your life? Pregnancies, because you get more estrogen in one pregnancy than you get in the entire rest of your life. So, we've got to also include pregnancies when we're thinking about estrogen. So busy worrying about hormone therapy. The oral contraceptive pill is also neuroprotective. And the studies that are looking at women with Alzheimer's disease and looking back and saying, have you used oral contraceptives, hormonal contraceptives? That is also neuroprotective. Yet we've got quite a backlash against the pill, even though it's appearing to be protective. And it's also, you'll score a little bit better on your cognitive testing. But because there's such a push against the pill, we're not talking about the upsides and the benefits to our brain of the oral contraceptive pill. And then, in some studies, but not all, there appears to be a slight benefit. Like if we're looking across all of the data, we would say estrogen is protective. And we know quite clearly, because young women in their 30s who have their ovaries removed, perhaps they have cancer, lose all of the estrogen, we see the cognitive impacts.
Right, right.
Does that mean every woman at 50 has had like her ovaries removed and is going to see the impacts? It's a different, because it's a different phase.
That's
but
very,
broadly yeah. speaking, we like a little bit of estrogen.
Interesting. Okay, so I guess let's wrap up with what is the take-home message? I mean, as far as like how women should think about this when they're thinking about, we've made it clear that if you're symptomatic, get help, and that's a great idea, and hormone therapy is very good for you. But like, what about all of the rest of us who are just like hearing these messages and going, I don't know, I feel good?
Well, think about where you're getting your messages from and why. And are you being fed? we're all being fed an algorithm. I only get menopause information at the moment on my Instagram and on my LinkedIn. And I think it's always, like to be completely cynical about it from my perspective, I'm like, who's giving me this information and why? What benefit is it of them to give me that information? Are they selling supplements? Are they, selling, appointments that cost thousands? Have they got some kind of benefit for giving me this particular piece of information? Or are they careful and cautious? Are they talking about absolute risk? Are they taking a measured approach? Are they non-reactive to people wanting to have discussions and about what's going on? I personally wouldn't be getting healthcare information solely from social media, because you're only ever going to get the extreme messages. And we all know that, but we seem to have forgotten it. So the discourse, as I said, has gone from fear and avoidance to FOMO. And everything does these days. It doesn't matter what we're talking about. You can't meet anyone anywhere in the middle anymore. So just think about that. What's the source of your messaging? And know that when it comes to your brain, you have had a lifetime up until this point in which you've been able to pull a whole lot of levers. Your education, your social networks.
Exercise.
Your exercise, your diet, your overall lifestyle, your ability to respond to stress. How much, your phone stresses you out. You're getting this constant stream of information via that you're meant to be making some sense of as well. So there's a lot of things that we can do to keep our brains healthy. And just for now, we're in this point in time and we're not entirely sure which is the best kind of way to go. So throw everything at what you do know.
Excellent. I appreciate you. You've echoed again that estrogen and your hormones are just one part of the chorus, that makes everything.
And a voice in the crowd. And they're really loud sometimes, but, just kind of just sit back and listen. I appreciate you asking these questions so much, because especially the absolute relative risk, it's just so important. And how we respond to the messages we receive are really important in terms of what's happening in our bodies, because our brains are making sense of that data input too, and then going, oh, what does that mean for me?
Well, that's our show. Come on back next week when I sit down with Sarah Max, who at the age of 49 this year will be the oldest participant in the Lifetime Grand Prix bike racing series. And that's something that she didn't always love to talk about, but is embracing these days. And I'm sure glad she is. So come on back for that one. And until then, as always, stay feisty. You've been listening to Hit Play, Not Pause, a feisty menopause podcast for active, performance-minded women. I'm your host, Celine Yeager. The show is edited and produced by the strong, talented, and amazing women at Live Feisty Media. Follow us on social media at Feisty Menopause. And please help us spread the word. Screenshot and share this episode on your social media channels with the tag at Feisty Menopause. Share the show with your friends. And please subscribe, like, review, and rate this show wherever you get your podcasts. Word of mouth and good reviews make it easier for other listeners to find. Thanks for listening, and as always, stay feisty.